me through in my sleep when I noticed something. Someone, a mean-looking, saggy-lipped man from the benches, had stolen a pippin from Grace and was biting into it as she asked him for the penny it cost. He tried to bat her away like a fly, but Grace was Grace, so she stood her ground. She was shouting words I couldn't hear, but knowing Grace, I could guess them. As she was standing in the way of another man, she was now getting into broader bother. This man, a grizzled, brown-toothed brute in ale-soaked clothes, pushed Grace to the floor, sending her apples flying to the ground amid the sand and the nut and oyster shells, triggering a memory of all those scattered plums on Fairfield Road. Then it was a free-for-all, as several people jostled to grab the apples. Grace got to her feet, and the first man, the apple thief, then grabbed her and made a gargoyle of his face, shoving his tongue in her ear. I had, by this point, stopped playing. Hal, next to me, tapped my foot while still playing his flute, as the actors continued singing below. I heard Christopher sighing his disapproval behind me. So I began to start playing again, but then spied Rose leaving her basket and rushing back through the pit, concerned for her sister. She reached Grace, who was still having trouble with the ear licker, when the apple thief's companion made a grab at her, pulling up her skirt and reaching his hand beneath it. She slapped him. He yanked at her hair. I felt her distress as if it was my own, just as Grace was elbowing her harasser hard in the face, bloodying his nose. I didn't know what happened next, because I was climbing over the oakwood rail of the balcony, holding my lute like a club, and, to the sound of a thousand gasps, jumping down onto the stage. I landed on top of Will Kemp, then shouldered past a shocked Shakespeare himself as I lunged forward and leapt off the stage to reach Rose and Grace. I ran around the side of the pit and pushed my way through as nuts and ale and apples were thrown in my direction from the angry crowd. The play went on behind me, as the play always did, but I doubt if even those in the fivepenny seats could hear a word that was being said, such was the commotion now in the pit and around the benches. Even in the balconies, people were roaring and jeering and raining their theatre food down on me. Rose was fine now. She had broken free of her lecherous assailant and was trying to help Grace, who was still in trouble, being held in a headlock with a thick arm squeezed hard around her neck. Between Rose and myself, we managed to get Grace free. I grabbed the sisters' hands and urged them, "We have to go." But there was potentially an even bigger problem now. One of the men from the expensive seats was now standing in our path as we tried to get out of the theatre. I hadn't spotted him, and I doubt he had spotted me before I had leapt out of the gallery. He stood tall and strong and solid, better dressed than I had seen him last, with his thinning hair flattened in stripes across his head, clasping those thick butcher's hands in front of him. "So," said Manning, looking down at me with his one good eye. "I see it is true. You made it to London. How long is it since I saw you last? It seems only yesterday. You haven't changed in the slightest, but then you don't, do you?" "I see it is true." I would never know for sure if Christopher had spread his suspicions about me beyond the musicians' gallery. Nor would I ever know if the men who manhandled Rose and Grace were in on the whole thing. "I see you have made some friends." "No," I said, as if a word could cancel a reality. He surveyed a confused Grace and Rose.
"No?"
"They are not my friends," I said, determined he knew as little about the sisters as possible or their connection to me. "I have never seen them before this day." I gestured with my eyes for Rose to leave, but she wouldn't.
"Ah, and still he lies. Well, be aware of this, girls, for he is not what he seems. He is an unnatural malevolence incarnate, a witch's boy."
"My mother died an innocent woman. She died because of you."
"Her last charm, for all God knows. Perhaps she changed form. Perhaps she stands among us now."
He stared at Rose, then Grace, as if trying to read an abstruse text. I couldn't stay another moment. The nightmare was coming true. A mere knowledge of me was a danger to anyone. My very existence, a curse. The crowd around us was becoming still, but watching Manning more than the stage. I recognized a face staring at me. I didn't know his name, but I knew he was a knife grinder. I had seen him on the bridge of a morning, plying his trade. He was a pale, weak-looking, skinny man, no more than 20, who always wore a belt of shining knives. I contemplated grabbing one of them, but that would only have assured me a one-way ticket to Tyburn and a noose around my neck. But I knew it was too late. The risk of Manning knowing I knew the girls was less than the risk of my leaving and them staying with him. So I implored Rose. We must leave.
I will kill thee 150 ways. Therefore tremble and depart.
But then even the actors fell quiet, as Manning grabbed a handful of Grace's hair.
This one! Manning shouted. How many years has she?
Grace was kicking at him.
Has she 20? Has she 30? She might have 60 years to her. She looks like a child. But we know of other deceptions, don't we?
Grace punched him hard in the groin.
Get off me, you eel, you piss cunt!
But it seemed no good. The crowd was with Manning and against us. We would be contained here. Manning would get some kind of hearing. Accusations of witchcraft and devilry would follow. I had endangered Rose and Grace. The only thing that could have saved us right at that moment was the one thing that did.
Pray, get thy hands off that young girl.
It was Shakespeare himself, front of stage and out of character. Manning held on.
I am William Manning. I am the...
I care not, said Shakespeare. These players care not. This globe cares not. Unhand her and free her and her friends afore we end this play. This was enough. The threat of no more of the performance was enough. Even then it was clear that the masses wanted something far more than justice. They wanted entertainment. And Shakespeare knew that as well as anyone. The whole theatre was now jeering at William Manning. Oyster shells were flung at his reddening face. A nerve bulged blue in his forehead. His hand let go of Grace. We clutched onto her as we made our way towards the side of the building, our feet crunching the detritus in the sand. I turned to the stage, wondering if Shakespeare had returned. He caught my glance. Then, when he spoke to the enlivened crowd, to tell them the rest of the performance was dedicated to an actor to whom he owed a debt, a man by the name of Henry Hemmings. I knew it was a message, a code, and one intended for me. And so it was that I knew we could never return to the Globe or Bankside ever again. Hackney, outside London, 1599. Gossip. Gossip lived. It wasn't just a currency, it had a life. Stories buzzed and hummed and circulated like gadflies in the air, hovering amid the stench of sewage and the clatter of carts. For instance, when Mary Peters suddenly went missing, every household to the east of the wall seemed to know about it. Rose, incidentally, had been so upset about that, she hardly spoke for a day. And now, due to what Rose called the heat of my tempers, the story of the lutist who jumped onto the stage at the Globe would surely be talked about in every inn in London. But you and Grace were in trouble. We can handle ourselves. We always have. And now we shall have to go back to Whitechapel. The conversation turned and headed where I knew it would. She wanted to know who the man was. Manning. I don't know.
That is a lie.
I can't tell you who he is.
He said your mother was a witch. What was his meaning?
He must have been confused. He must have mistaken me for somebody else. Her green eyes glared at me, alive with quiet fury.
Do you take me for a fool, Tom Smith?
And it was that, the saying of the name that was only half mine, that made me feel I had to tell her something. Forgive me, Rose. It was a mistake. I should never have come here. I should have earned the money I owed and left. I should never have let my feelings for you grow, and I should never let you feel anything for me.
What are you saying, Tom? Your talk is a puzzle.
Yes. Yes, it is. And I am a puzzle, too. And you won't solve it. I can't even solve it myself. I had stood up from the stool and was pacing around in frantic circles. Grace was now asleep in her room, so I kept my voice low but urgent.
You need to find someone else. Look at me. Look at me, Rose. I am too young for you. 2 years, Tom? That is not such a difference.
The difference will grow. She looked confused.
How can it? What can you mean, Tom? How can a difference grow? You are not making sense.
I am no use to you now. I can't go back to Southwark.
Use? Use? You have my heart, Tom.
I exhaled heavily. I wanted to sigh away reality. I wanted the tear that was in her eye never to fall. I wanted her to hate me. I wanted not to love her. Well, you gave it to the wrong person.
Tell me about your mother, Tom. The truth.
Her eyes wouldn't let me lie. The reason they killed her is me.
What?
There is something most strange about me, Rose.
What is it?
I'm not growing older.
What? Look at me.
Time passes, but not on my face. I'm in love with you.
I am. I truly am. And what use is that? I am like a boy trying to climb a tree, but the branches keep getting higher and higher.
She was so dumbfounded by what I was saying, she could only utter,
I am not a tree.
You will look 50 years old, and I will still look like this. It is best you leave me. It is best I go. It is best I... And she kissed me then, simply because she wanted me to stop talking. And she could only half believe it. For days, she thought I was insane. But as the weeks and months passed by, she realized it was true. It was something she couldn't comprehend. Yet there it was. There it was. My truth. London. Now. I have no idea if anything I have said to Anton has got through. I have only been alive for 439 years, which is, of course, nowhere near long enough to understand the minimal facial expressions of the average teenage boy. So, it is pretty late, 12:20, when I finally make it into the staff room for lunch break. I sit there inhaling the scent of instant coffee and processed ham. My headache is bad today. Also, I have tinnitus. I get that, too, sometimes. I've had it on and off since the near-deafening artillery fire I heard in the Spanish Civil War. I no longer go to the supermarket at lunch. Instead, I make my own sandwich in the morning. But I'm not even hungry, so I just sit there, eyes closed. When I open them, I see Isham, the geography teacher, busy working out which sachet of herbal tea to put in his mug. I also see Camille. She is on the other side of the room and is peeling open her carton of salad. She has apple juice, too, and a book, which she is using as a kind of makeshift little tray. Daphne, taking a clementine from the communal fruit bowl, gives me a smile that might be a smirk.
How are you, Tom? How are things going?
Good, I say. I feel good. She nods, knowing it is a lie.
It will get better. The first 10 years here are always the hardest.
She laughs and heads out of the staff room to her office. I feel bad about Camille. I had been rude to her the last time we had spoken. I notice now that she is taking something out of her pocket. A pill. She swallows it down with the help of some apple juice. I should just stay in my seat. That is what Hendry would want me to do. I mean, it is now, from an Albatross Society point of view, perfect. Camille will probably never speak to me again. Yet, here I am, crossing the room. I just want to say sorry, I tell her.
What for?
She says, which is good of her. I sit down so I can speak to her at a lower volume and less suspiciously. Another teacher, a maths teacher called Stephanie, is frowning at us as she eats a plum. I didn't mean to be so weird, so rude.
Well, some people can't help it. Some people are just like that.
Well, I didn't mean to be.
What we are and what we mean are different things. It's fine. The world makes it very hard not to be a prick.
She just says it casually, gently.
I have never been so insulted, so delicately.
I try to explain without explaining. I have a lot of stuff going on. And I have one of those faces, generic. I get a lot of people thinking I'm a friend of a friend, or some actor they've seen on TV. She nods, unconvinced.
That's probably it, then. Let's say it's that.
I then notice the book beneath Camille's salad. It is a novel. I wonder if it is the novel she had been reading that day I saw her in the park. A Penguin classic. Tender is the Night by F. Scott Fitzgerald, with a photograph of the author on the front cover. She must have seen me staring.
Oh, have you read it? What do you think?
I find it hard to talk. The memories jam my mind like too many open windows on a computer, or too much water in a boat. My headache rises. I don't know. Each word feels like an oar in the water. Boats against the current, I say aloud.
Boats against the current? Gatsby?
I hold my breath, and I am now in a staff room in London and a bar in Paris, all at once, torn between centuries, between place and time, now and then, water and air. Paris, 1928. I was on my own, walking the long walk home from the Grand Hotel where I'd been doing my shift, playing the piano for the rich Americans and Europeans who were enjoying tea or cocktails. I felt alone. I needed to be around people to mask the loneliness inside myself. So I headed into the thronging buzz of Harry's bar, as I did on occasion. Almost everyone in there was from somewhere else, which was always the kind of crowd I liked. I fought my way to the bar and found a place next to a glamorous couple with matching center partings. The man looked at me and maybe sensed my loneliness. "Try the Bloody Mary," he said.
"What's that?"
"It's the thing. A cocktail. Z loves it, don't you, sweetheart?" The woman looked at me with sad, heavy eyes. She was either drunk or ready for sleep, or both. They both looked pretty drunk now that I thought about it. She nodded.
"It is a great ally in the war."
"Which war is that?" I wondered aloud.
"The war against boredom. It is a very real war. It is a war in which the enemy is all around us."
I ordered the Bloody Mary. I was surprised to see it involved tomato juice. The man eyeballed the woman sternly. It was hard to tell if it was fake stern or the real deal.
"I have to say, I feel mildly insulted when you talk like that, see?" "Oh, not you, Scott. You haven't been too dull. This has been one of your better evenings."
It was then he held out his hand. "Scott Fitzgerald, and this is Zelda." The great thing about being deep into your fourth century was that you rarely got starstruck. But even so, it was quite something to accidentally happen upon the author of the book that was beside your bed. "I've just finished reading your book, The Great Gatsby, and I read This Side of Paradise when it came out. He suddenly seemed sober.
What did you make of it? Of Gatsby?
Everyone prefers Paradise. Everyone. My publishers struggle on with the poor thing, out of pity, mainly. Zelda made a face as if she was about to be sick.
That Durst jacket. Ernest is so seldom right about anything, but he was right about that. It is a war against eyes.
Not everything is a war, sweetheart.
Of course it is, Scott.
They looked like they were about to squabble, so I interjected. Well, I thought it was exceptional. The book, I mean. Zelda nodded. She looked like a child, I realized. They both did. They looked like children dressing up in grown-up clothes. There was such a fragile innocence to them.
I try to tell him it is good, she said. You can tell him and tell him and tell him, but it is just raindrops against the roof.
Scott seemed relieved I liked it, though. Well, that makes you a better person than the guy at the Herald Tribune. Now, there's your drink. He handed me the Bloody Mary.
They invented it here, you know, said Zelda.
I sipped the strange drink. Did they really? And then Scott interrupted and said,
Tell us, what do you do?
I play piano at Ciro's. As in the Paris Ciro's? He asked.
Rue d'Anou?
How wonderful. You win already. Zelda took a long mouthful of some kind of gin cocktail.
What are you scared of?
Scott smiled apologetically. It's her drunk question. Every time. Scared of?
Everyone is scared of something. I'm scared of bedtime. And housekeeping. And all the things you have housemaids for. Scott is scared of reviews. And Hemingway. And loneliness.
I am not scared of Hemingway. I tried to think. I wanted, for once, to give an honest answer. I'm scared of time. Zelda smiled, leaning her head in a kind of glazed sympathy or resignation.
You mean growing old?
No, I mean
Scotty and I don't plan to grow old, do we?
The plan is, Scott added, with exaggerated seriousness, to hop from one childhood to the next. I sighed, hoping this would make me appear thoughtful and serious and in possession of a great golden age intelligence. The trouble is, if you live long enough, you end up running out of childhoods eventually. Zelda offered me a cigarette, which I accepted. I was smoking now. Everyone was smoking now. And then placed one in Scott's mouth and another in her own. A kind of wild despair flared suddenly in her eyes as she struck the match.
Grow up or crack up, she said
after the first inhale.
The divine choices we have.
If only we could find a way to stop time, said her husband. That's what we need to work on. You know, for when a moment of happiness floats along, we could swing our net and catch it like a butterfly and have that moment forever. Zelda was now looking across the crowded bar.
The trouble is, they stick pins in butterflies, and then they are dead.
She seemed to be looking for someone.
Sherwood's gone. But oh, look, it's Gertrude and Alice.
And within moments, they disappeared through the packed room with their cocktails, and though they made it perfectly clear I could join them, I stayed there, with nothing but vodka and tomato juice for company, staying in the safe shadows of history. London, now. It is strange how close the past is, even when you imagine it to be so far away. Strange how it can just jump out of a sentence and hit you. Strange how every object or word can house a ghost. The past is not one separate place. It is many, many places, and they are always ready to rise into the present. One minute it is the 1590s, the next it is the 1920s, and it is all related. It is all the accumulation of time. It builds up and builds up and can catch you violently off guard at any moment. The past resides inside the present, repeating, hiccuping, reminding you of all the stuff that no longer is. It bleeds out from road signs and plaques on park benches and songs and surnames and faces and the covers of books. Sometimes just the sight of a tree or a sunset can smack you with the power of every tree or sunset you have ever seen, and there is no way to protect yourself. There is no possible way of living in a world without books or trees or sunsets. There just isn't. Are you okay? Camille asks me, her hand resting on the cover of her book, so only the word tender is visible. Yes, I'm still getting these headaches, though. Have you been to the doctor? No, but I will. Going to the doctor, of course, is the last thing I am going to do. I look at her. She has the kind of face that makes you want to speak, to tell things to. It is a dangerous face. Maybe you need some more sleep, she says. I wonder what she means, and she can see me wondering, because then she says, I saw on Facebook that you liked my post at 3 in the morning. That's an interesting time for you to be awake on a school night. Oh, there is a sliver of mischief in her smile. Is it a habit of yours? Spying on women's Facebook pages in the middle of the night? I feel ashamed. It came up on my feed. I'm only joking with you, Tom. You need to lighten up a little bit. If only she could understand the weight of things, the gravity of time. I'm sorry, I say, for the heaviness. It's all right. Life is like that sometimes. Maybe she does understand. I'm just a bit awkward around people. I get it. L'enfer, c'est les autres. Sartre? Oui, dix points, Sartre. Mr. Comedy himself. I force a smile and don't say anything, because the only thing I have in my head is that the sight of her face comforts me and scares me all at once. So instead I ask her something. It is a question I have often asked over the years. The question is, do you know anyone called Marion? She frowns. I really confuse her. A French Marion? Or an English one? English, I say. Or either. She thinks. I went to school with a Marion. Marion Ray. She told me about periods. My parents were prudes. They never told me. And it is quite a thing not to be told about, you know, this blood coming out of you. She says this at a normal volume. There are still other people in the room. Stephanie is still frowning at us, holding the stone of her plum between her fingers. Isham is on his mobile phone, 2 seats away. I like her lack of shame. I know I should engage in chit-chat. I know all the signs that chit-chat is required are there. But I ignore the signs. Any other Marians?
No, I'm sorry.
That's all right. I'm sorry. That is all I really wanted to say. She smiles and looks at me, and finds something in my gaze that troubles her. I feel she is trying to think where she knows me from again.
Life is always mysterious, she says. But some mysteries are bigger than others.
And then there is a little silence, and I force another smile, and I walk away. Part 4. The Pianist. Bisbee, Arizona, 1926. It was August. I was in the living room of a small timber house on the edge of town. On assignment for Hendrich. Every 8 years, there was an assignment. That was the deal. You did the assignment, and then you moved on to the next place, and Hendrich helped you change your identity and kept you safe. The only time you were ever in danger was during the assignment itself. Though I had been lucky. I had done 3 assignments before this one, and they had all been successful. In other words, I had managed to locate the Albers in question and convince them to join the society. No violence had been necessary, no real test of character. But here, in Bisbee, everything changed. Here, I was about to find out who I was, and the lengths I would go to find Marion. Even though it was now evening and the dark was quickly dissolving the red mountains outside the window, the heat was intense. It was like the burning air outside, but concentrated, like someone had decided to squeeze all of the desert heat into that timber house. Sweat dripped off my nose and onto the nine of diamonds.
"You ain't used to heat much, are you? Where you been hiding? Alaska? You've been gold-digging up in Yukon?"
That was the skinny, toothless one who asked that. The one with two fingers missing on his left hand. The one who went by the name of Louis. He took another slug of whiskey and swallowed it down without a flinch. "Been hiding all over," I said. "I have to." Then the other one, Joe, the one who just surprised me with a royal flush, the larger, cleverer one, started to laugh ominously.
"This is all very interesting and all, and we always appreciate supping moonshine with strangers, especially ones with some green in their pockets. But you ain't from Cochise County. Can always tell, just from your clothes. See, everyone around here has a taint to them. From the dust. From the mines. You don't see no cotton that white round Bisbee. And look at your hands. Clean as snow."
I looked down at my hands. I was very used to the sight of them these days, from all the music I'd been playing. I had taught myself piano. That is what I had done with the last 8 years. "Hands are hands," I said pathetically. We had been playing poker for over an hour. I'd already lost $120. I drank some more of the whiskey. It felt like fire. Now was the time, I realized. Now I had to say what I had come here to say. "I know who you two are."
"Oh?" said Joe.
A clock ticked. Outside, far away, something howled. A dog or a coyote. I cleared my throat. "You are like me."
"Sure doubt that."
Joe again, with a laugh as dry as the desert. "Joe Thompson, that's your name, is it?"
"What you digging at, mister?"
"Not Billy Stiles, not William Larkin." Louis then sat up tall, his face hardened.
"Who are you?"
"I have been many people, just like you. Now, what should I call you, Louis, or Jess Dunlop, or John Patterson, or maybe Three-Fingered Jack? And that's just the start, no?" Four eyes and two guns were now staring hard at me. Never seen anyone so quick on the draw as those two. It was them, all right. They pointed at the pistol I was carrying.
"Place it on the table, nice and slow."
I did so. "I'm not here for trouble. I'm here to keep you safe. I know who you are. I know at least some of the people you have been. I know you haven't always been working in a copper mine. I know about the train you robbed at Fairbank. I know about the Southern Pacific Express you took for more than most can ever dream of. I know neither of you need to be mining for copper." Joe was clenching his jaw so hard I thought he was going to lose teeth, but I kept going. "I know the two of you were meant to have been shot 26 years ago in Tombstone." I dug in my pocket and pulled out the pictures Hendrick had got hold of. "And I know these photographs of you were taken 30 years ago, and you have hardly aged a day." They didn't even break away to look at the photos. They knew who they were, and they knew I knew who they were, too. I had to talk. "Listen, I'm not trying to get you into any trouble. I'm just trying to explain that it's all right. There are lots of people like you. I don't know your whole story, but you both look about the same age. I'm guessing you were born shortly after 1700. Now, I don't know if during that time you have come into contact with other people with this condition, apart from each other, but I can assure you there are many of them. Many of us. Thousands, possibly. And our condition is dangerous. It has been called by a doctor in England, anageria. When it becomes public, either because we decide to tell people or people find us out. Then we are in danger, and the people we care for are in danger. We are either locked away in a madhouse, pursued and imprisoned in the name of science, or murdered by the servants of superstition. So, as I'm sure you know, your lives are at risk. Louis scratched his stubble.
From this side of the gun, looks like you are the one whose life hangs in the breeze.
Joe was frowning. So what are you asking us, mister? A deep breath. I'm just here with a proposition. Look, people here in Bisbee already have their suspicions about you. Word is leaking out. This is the age of photography now. Our past has evidence. As I was hearing myself, with fear slowly creeping into my voice, I realized how much I was simply parroting Hendrich. Everything I was saying was the kind of thing Hendrich said. There was something hollow to every word. There's a society, like a union, working for the collective good. We are trying to get every person with this condition they call anageria, to be part of the society. It helps people. It assists them when they need to move on and begin being someone else. That help can be money, and it can be in the form of papers and documents. Joe and Louis exchanged thoughts with their eyes. Louis's eyes were duller, less illuminated with intelligence. He looked dangerously stupid. But he was the more malleable one, the one most likely to be sold. Joe was the strong one, in body and mind. Joe was the one who held his colt without a quiver.
"How much money you talking?"
Louis asked, as an insect buzzed around his head. "It depends on need. The society allocates budgets according to the requirements of each particular case." God, I really was starting to sound like Hendrich. Joe shook his head.
"Didn't you hear the man, Louis? He's telling us to move out of Bisbee. And that just ain't gonna work, see? We've got it good here. We have good relations with folk here. We done our roaming, and I've been all over this country since I got off the boat all those years ago. And I ain't been told to move."
"It will be best for you if you do. You see, the society says that after 8 years..." Joe sighed a sigh that was halfway to a growl.
The society says we ain't in no society and we ain't ever gonna be in no society. You understand me?"
"I'm sorry, but..."
"I want to put a hole in that head of yours.
Listen, the society have contacted the law officials. They know I'm here. If you shoot me, you will be caught." They both laughed at this.
"You hear that, Louis?"
"I heard him all right."
"Best we explain to Mr. Peter, whichever his name is, why the joke is funny."
"You can call me Tom. See? I'm like you. I've had many names." Joe ignored me completely and carried on with his train of thought.
"It's all right. I'll do it. See, the joke is funny, 'cause there ain't no law that touches us round here. This here ain't an ordinary town. We've been helping Sheriff Downey and old P.D. out for some time now."
P.D. Phelps Dodge. I'd been given enough information about Bisbee to know that Phelps Dodge was the major mining company in the area.
"In actual fact," Joe went on, "we helped them instigate the Bisbee deportation. You know about that, right?"
I knew something about it. I knew that in 1919, hundreds of striking miners had been roughly kidnapped and deported out of town.
"So, coming here and talking about propositions and your little union ain't gonna sway us too much. The last union man we dealt with, we kicked all the way to New Mexico, and we did it with the sheriff's seal of approval. Now, you really do look hot and bothered. Let's go for a little walk and cool your blood a little."
It was dark now. Desert dark. The air was turning chill, but I was sweating and sore and aching, and my whiskey-sour mouth was as dry as the grave I had been digging for over an hour. Bullets weren't infections. They weren't the plague, or one of the 100 or so illnesses Albers were able to resist. As with ultimate old age, there was no immunity from a bullet. And I didn't want to die. I had to stay alive for Marion. Hendry had convinced me we were getting closer to finding her. At least one of them had had their revolver fixed on me the whole time I'd been digging. This situation didn't change as they beckoned me out of the hole. And all the time their two dark, saddlebred horses stayed nibbling and whispering at each other. "Now," said Joe as I hauled myself out, making sure I kept hold of the shovel as I did so. I leaned on it as a kind of resting aid. "We ain't burying your money with you. Empty those pockets and place all you have on the ground." I knew this was the moment, the only one I would get. I gave a curious glance towards the horses, causing the men to do the same. By the time Joe's cold, hard eyes were back upon me, the shovel was swinging fast towards his face. He fell back, semi-conscious, losing his hold of the gun, which landed with a thud in the dust.
"Kill him," slurred Joe.
Louis, the one I'd gambled on being a little more cowardly, a little slower on the trigger, fired a shot as I was scrambling for Joe's gun. The noise echoed around the desert as I felt the pain in my back, near my right shoulder. But I had Joe's gun and one good arm, and I turned and shot Louis in the neck, and he fired again, but only hit the knight that time. Then I shot Joe a couple of times too, and there was blood slick black in the dark, and somehow inside my pain I managed to kick and roll them into the grave I had dug and put the earth back on them. I slapped the rump of one of the horses, causing it to gallop away, before I hauled myself on the other one. The pain was beyond anything I had known, but somehow I made it away, and I kept going, and I kept going, and I kept going across the desert and over dry hills and mountains and past a large quarry that seemed to my delirious mind like the blackness of death itself calling me towards it like the river Styx. I resisted, and the horse kept walking through that night until I reached Tucson as the morning sun slowly bled its light into the sky, and I found the Arizona Inn, where Agnes poured alcohol on my wound, and I bit into a wet towel to mask my screams as she tweezed the bullet out of my flesh. Los Angeles, 1926. My bullet wound was healing, but there was still pain in my shoulder. I was at the Garden Court Apartments and Hotel on Hollywood Boulevard, in the restaurant they had there. All marble and columns and grandeur. A mesmerizing-looking woman with dark, painted lips and a ghostly pale face sat at a table not too far away, talking to two fawning men in business suits. It was Lillian Gish, the movie star. I recognized her from Orphans of the Storm, a film set during the French Revolution. For a moment or two, I was entranced. I had come to love the cinema during my time in Albuquerque, where I'd been stationed for the last 8 years. The way you could just sit on your own in the dark and forget who you were. Just let yourself feel what the film was telling you to feel for an hour or so.
"They have them all in here,"
Hendrich was explaining discreetly as he set about his halibut in shrimp sauce.
"Gloria Swanson, Fairbanks, Fatty Arbuckle, Valentino. Just last week Chaplin was at this very table, in your seat. He just had the soup. That was his entire meal, just soup."
Hendry grinned. I had never hated that grin until now.
"What's the matter, Tom? Is it the beef? It can be a little overdone."
"The beef is fine."
"Oh, so it's about what happened in Arizona."
I almost laughed at this. What else would it be about? I had to kill two men.
"Quiet now. I doubt Miss Gish wants to hear such things. Discretion, Tom, please."
"Well, I don't see why we had to do this in the restaurant. I thought you had an apartment upstairs." He looked confused.
"I like the restaurant.
It's always good to be around people. Don't you enjoy being around people, Tom? I will tell you what I don't enjoy. He glided his hand through the air, as if inviting me through a door. Please do, he said. Tell me what you don't enjoy, if that makes you happy. I leaned forward to whisper. I don't enjoy fleeing a murder scene on a horse with a bullet lodged in my shoulder. A bullet! And... I was losing my flow. I didn't want to do that. I didn't want to kill them. He sighed philosophically. What was it Dr. Johnson said? He who makes a beast of himself gets rid of the pain of being a man. Do you know what I think? I think you are finding yourself. You were lost. You didn't even know who or what you were. You had no purpose. You were living in poverty. You were moping around, burning yourself to feel something. Now, look, you have a purpose. He waited a beat or two. This shrimp sauce is really divine. The waiter came over and poured some more wine. We concentrated on our food until he disappeared again. A piano started to play. Some of the diners leaned over the backs of their seats to have a look at the pianist for a moment or two. I'm just saying I didn't like it. Those men were never going to join the society. You should have known that. I should have been told that, Hendrich. Please try to call me Cecil. They know me as Cecil here. My story is that I made my money in San Francisco. Property development. I helped rebuild the city. After the quake, don't I look like a Cecil? Call me Cecil. They'll think I'm Cecil B. DeMille. I can make them a star. It might get me some action. He drifted off into more thought. I love this town. They're all coming here now, all these young farm girls from South Dakota or Oklahoma or Europe. This city has always been the same, apparently. In the Ice Age, animals used to come and get stuck in the tar pits that looked like shimmering lakes, and the smell of the meat would bring other animals there to be trapped in that thick, black tar. Anyway, I'm a safe kind of predator. They think I'm past it at 78. 78! Imagine that! At 78, I was fucking my way around Flanders. I was incorrigible. The amount of marriage proposals I made. I was the Valentino of the lowlands. I took a big gulp of wine. I can't do this, Henry. I can't do it. Cecil, please. I'm sorry I went to Dr. Hutchinson. Seriously, I am. But I want my old life back. I just want to be me again. I am afraid that is, as they say, impossible. Time moves forwards. We have the luxury of time, but we still can't reverse it. We can't stop it. We are one-way traffic, just the same as all these mayflies. You can't simply cut away from the society any more than you can be unborn. You do understand that, don't you, Tom? And what about your daughter, Tom? We are going to find her. We will. But you haven't. Yet, Tom. We haven't yet. I sense she is out there, Tom. I know she is out there. She is there, Tom. I said nothing. I was angry, yes, but as was so often the case with anger, it was really just fear projecting outwards. The society was nothing. It had no physical presence in the real world. There was no stone plaque outside a grand building announcing its existence. It was just Hendrich and the people who had faith in him. And yet, Hendrich was enough. His aptitude. Indeed, maybe it was that aptitude that caused him to reel me in again with just the right words. Maybe it wasn't just words, either. Maybe he actually could sense she was out there. But then, a thought. If your aptitude is so good, Then why didn't you know? Why didn't you know they could have killed me?
They didn't kill you. If they had killed you, then yes, I would have made a terrible mistake. But the fact is that you are a survivor, and I knew that, and it has been proven. Obviously, we are all survivors. But you, I don't know. There is something special about you. You have a desire to live. Most people who get to your age feel like everything is behind them. But when I look at you, I see a thirst for the future, a yearning for it. For your daughter, yes, but for something else, too. The great unknown.
But what kind of life is it? Having to change who you are every 8 years.
You had to change who you were before. What is the difference?
The difference is that I could decide. It was my life. He shook his head and smiled solemnly.
No. You were in retreat. You were hiding from life. You were hiding, if I dare say, from yourself.
But that's what the society is for, isn't it? To hide?
No, Tom, no. You misunderstand everything. Look at us. In the center of the most famous restaurant in a sunlit city everyone wants to visit. We are not hiding. We are not tucked away in St. Albans, pulling metal out of a forge. The aim of the society is to provide a structure, a system, which enables us to enhance our lives. You do the occasional favor, a spot of recruitment, and you get to live a good life. And this is how you thank me.
I have just spent 8 years on a farm in Albuquerque with nothing but 3 cows and some cacti for company. It seems the society works better for some than it does for others. Hendry shook his head.
I have a letter for you, from Reginald Fisher. You remember? The man you recruited in Chicago.
He handed me the letter, and I read it. It was a long letter. The one line that stood out was this one, near the end. I would have betrayed God to finish myself if you had never come and seen me. But I feel so happy now, knowing I am not a freakish specimen of humanity, but part of a family.
All right. Arizona was a mistake. But not everything has been. Lives are lost in wars, but it doesn't mean they shouldn't ever be fought. You had a piano, Tom. Did you play it?
5 hours a day.
So how many instruments can you play now?
Around 30.
That's impressive.
Not really. Most of them no one wants to hear anymore. It's hard to play Gershwin on a lute.
Yes.
Hendrich ate the last of his fish. Then he stared at me earnestly.
You are a murderer, Tom. Without the society's protection, you would be in a very vulnerable place right now. You need us. But I don't want you to stay out of sheer necessity, Tom. I hear you, I do. And I will never forget the people whose lives you have saved by bringing them into the society. So, from now on, I am going to be a little more considerate of your needs. I am going to allocate a few more resources to finding Marion. We've got some new people. Someone in London, someone in New York, one in Scotland, another in Vienna. I'll get them working on it. And, of course, I will fund those needs.
I am going to listen. I am going to help you as much as I can. I want you to thrive, Tom.
I want you to find not just Marion, but the future you are waiting for.
A group of 4 men entered the room and were escorted to a table. One of them had the most recognizable face on the planet. It was Charlie Chaplin. He spotted Lillian Gish and went over and spoke to her, his calm expression punctuated by the occasional quick, nervous smile. She laughed gracefully. I had breathed the same air as Shakespeare, and now I was breathing the same air as Chaplin. How could I be ungrateful? "We are the invisible threads of history," Hendrich told me, as if reading my mind. Chaplin saw us looking, and tipped an invisible bowler hat in our direction.
"See? Told you. He loves this place. Must be the soup. Now, what do you want to do with your life?"
I considered the attention Chaplin was getting, and couldn't think of a greater nightmare. Then, as I continued to contemplate the question, I stared at the pianist in his white dinner jacket, closing his eyes and drifting away, note by note, bar by bar, unnoticed, except by me. "That," I said, nodding in the pianist's direction. "That is what I want to do." London, now.
But why couldn't the League of Nations stop Mussolini from entering Abyssinia?
Armina is in the front row, serious, frowning, alert, holding a pencil. She is wearing a T-shirt that says, "Proud Snowflake." I am giving a lesson on the causes of the Second World War, trying to go back from 1939 through the 1930s, talking about Italy taking over Abyssinia, now Ethiopia, in 1935, as well as Hitler's rise in 1933, the Spanish Civil War, and the Great Depression. Well, they tried, but in a really half-hearted way. Economic sanctions, but nothing that was majorly enforced. But the thing is, at the time, a lot of people didn't realize what they were dealing with. You see, when you look at events in history, there is a two-way perspective, forwards and back. But at the time, everything is one way. No one knew where fascism was heading. The lesson is going okay, and my headache isn't too bad. I think having made peace with Camille helped. But maybe because of this, I slip into a kind of autopilot. I'm not really thinking about what I'm saying. The news about Abyssinia felt like a real turning point, though. It made people realize something was happening. Not just with Germany, but Italy, too. With the world order. I remember reading a newspaper on the day Mussolini declared victory, and I... Fuck. I stop. Realize what I've said. Armina, sharp as her pencil, also notices.
"You said that as if you were there," she says.
A couple of other pupils nod in agreement.
"No, I wasn't there, but I felt I was."
"That's the thing with history. You inhabit it. It's another present."
Armina makes an amused face. I continue. I cover my tracks, I think. It is a pretty minor mistake to make, and yet it is the kind of mistake I never used to make. During the break, I see Camille chatting to someone out in the corridor. Leaning against some pupil artwork inspired by Rio's favelas, which looks very bright and fauvist and late 19th century. She is talking to Martin, the hopeless music teacher. Martin is wearing black jeans and a black T-shirt. He has a beard and longer hair than the average male teacher. I have no idea what they are talking about, but he is making Camille laugh. I feel a strange unease. And then I walk past, and Martin sees me first and smirks at me, as if I amuse him.
"Hi, Tim. You look a bit lost. Did they give you a map?"
"Tom," I say.
"You what, mate?"
"My name's Tom. It isn't Tim, it's Tom."
"All right, mate. Easy mistake."
Camille is smiling at me.
"How was your lesson?"
she asks, her eyes on me like a detective. A smiling detective, but still a detective.
"Fine," I say. "Listen, Tom, every Thursday a few of us go to the Coach and Horses for a couple of drinks. We meet at 7, me, Martin, Isham, Sarah. You should come along. Tell him, Martin."
Martin shrugs. "It's a free world."
"Yeah, knock yourself out."
Of course, there is only one answer I should give. No. But I glance at Camille and find myself saying,
"Yeah, okay. Coach and Horses, 7.
Sounds good. An interlude about the piano. I moved from place to place, and from time to time, like an arrow immune to gravity. Things did improve for a little while. My shoulder healed.